welcome to Mountain Monday. We don't have to remind you that the phone number is 649-9004 this week. Because
we heard that a lot last week, didn't we?
Boy, did we ever. But we wrapped up a fabulous pledge drive last Friday evening, and we'll have more about that later. But first, this is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and this is Mountain Money, and interesting show today. First, we're going to talk about about international business and the just the whole dilemma of dealing with people from a different culture, different language, and how to communicate and do business and not mess things up with some inadvertent wrong comment. We'll have Aaron Meyer with us, and Aaron is a professor at NCIAD University, which is the top business university in Europe, and she will be calling in from Paris. She has a new book called The Culture Map, Breaking Through the Invisible Boundaries of Global Business. So whether you do business internationally or just want to hear some interesting stories, stay tuned for Aaron.
Or even, you know, Larry, we're a fairly international town. Here in the wintertime, we have a lot of foreigners coming here to work and or play. So it helps understand people's vantage points. Our second guest this morning is going to be Michael Langer. He's an attorney, and he's going to talk to us about patent laws. So if you've always thought, hey, I've got a clever idea and I should patent it, we'll listen in for some free legal advice. And then our final guest is going to be Hillary Reeder of Redhead Marketing and PR. And they just opened a office in New York City, and we're going to talk to her about marketing and PR. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
Support for KPCW comes from the Park City Mountain Resort, committed to keeping the resort open this 2014-15 season for the community and for guests. More at keepparkcityopen.com.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. It looks like a day with scattered thunder showers predicted and a high of 71, really about a 40% chance, so it may happen and it may not. And on the line with us from Paris this morning, Aaron Meyer is joining us. Good morning, Aaron.
Hello, nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. This is a fascinating book, I must say, and I don't do any international business, but of course Park City is an international playground when it comes to skiing and film business with Sundance and all of that. And your book, The Culture Map, Breaking Through the Invisible Boundaries of Global Business, is all about doing business overseas. Now, English is the international language of business. At one time, French vied for that title, but if everybody's speaking in English, they're all, I suppose, speaking English from their perspective. An English sentence between a Chinese person and a Brazilian might come out and mean things that neither of them really expect.
That's right, and I think beyond language, this is what I work on is not just about understanding language differences, but understanding how we are raised in different parts of the world to build trust differently, to give criticism differently, how much information we're trained, how much personal information we're trained to share with people that we've just met. And that type of thing is really relevant whether you're negotiating with people in China or, as you said, maybe you have German tourists who have just walked into your shop, or maybe something personal like you've just found out that your son-in-law, new son-in-law from Brazil, is coming over for dinner. So what I do in my book is help people to tease out what these cultural differences are that may be impacting their effectiveness and then teach them strategies for improving their success.
Well, this has go ahead, Doug.
I was just going to say, Aaron, you've got some great examples in your book, and maybe the best way to start is with one of them. And one of the examples I enjoyed reading and I thought helped illustrate the point of cultural differences was the Mexican boss that got transferred to Europe. I believe it was a Scandinavian company. It was the beer company that bought the Mexican beer company. And just the differences in how a boss is viewed and how that impacted his ability to be successful. Can you share that example to kind of illustrate the point?
Yeah, so that's an example about a Dutch beer company that I worked with, and they purchased a big operation in Monterrey, Mexico. So the Netherlands is one of the most egalitarian cultures in the world. People really believe, you know, when they walk into a meeting, the boss is just a facilitator. Everyone is equal. And in Mexico, people are taught from a young age to defer to authority. So here I had these Mexicans I was working with who were now managing these Dutch teams, and they would say to me, wow, managing Dutch people is absolutely incredible because they do not care at all that I'm the boss. You know, I go into these meetings, I'm trying to roll out my strategy, but they're contradicting me, they're challenging me, they're taking my strategy off in other directions. Sometimes I just want to get down on my knees and plead with them, you know, please don't forget that I'm in charge here. So this is really complicated for people who are working in this global economy, because it means that today and more in the future, it's not enough to know how to work the Dutch way or the Mexican way or the American way. We have to know how to work all of these ways to be effective.
Can you rely on stereotypes? Are stereotypes of nationalities reality, or are there variations within cultures, or pretty much are the Dutch always going to behave like you would expect the Dutch to behave?
Well, one of the things that's important when we think about stereotypes is that how one culture stereotypes another may be entirely different from the way a third culture stereotypes that culture. So, for example, I worked a while ago with a British and French team, and I asked the British at one point, what's it like to work with the French? And the British said to me, well, Aaron, you know the French, they're really chaotic, they're always late, they're changing the topic in the middle of the meeting, so we can't follow them all the time. And then I had this Indian group that joined the same team, and after a while ago, I asked the Indians, what's it like to work with the French? And the Indians said to me, well, Aaron, you know the French, they're so rigid, they're so inadaptable, they're so focused on the structure and timeliness of things that they're not able to be adaptable to what's going on around them. So that just shows that when we're working in a global organization or a global environment, it's not enough to understand how does my culture see that culture, but how does another culture see that culture also. So I think that stereotypes are too simple for this very complex multicultural world that this global economy is leading us to.
Well, and I think, Larry, it's an important question, too. And, Aaron, you talk in your book about your research methodology, and it's really not based on stereotypes. It's really based on rigorous research. Tell us a little bit about how you came to map out, I think it was 8 factors, and where different countries, where different cultures fall on those maps.
Right. So I have a system breaking down culture into 8 types of behaviors that you may need to show during the day. So they look at during the workday. So they look at how to lead effectively, how to make decisions, how to build trust, how to give negative feedback, etc. And then I have countries that are mapped up next to one another on these scales so that you can analyze the differences and the similarities between the countries. And that's been done through many, many years of rigorous research. But that being said, my goal with the culture map was not to be super academic, but to help people think at a very practical level about how does this impact my success today. And just to give you like a very simple example of that, I worked, in the U.S., so I'm from Minnesota, and I've lived in France now 15 years, but I'm still, I'd say, deeply American in my roots. And in the U.S., we are taught to be really clear when we communicate. And we, after a telephone call, it's very frequent that we might recap what's been decided in writing and send that written recap to the person we just spoken to. I worked with an Indian a little while ago, and he said, you know, Aaron, in India, if we have a discussion on the telephone and we make some decisions verbally, that would be enough for me. And then if you get off the phone and you put into writing everything we've decided and you send that recap to me, that would be a clear sign to me that you don't trust me. So if you're aware of that, you can make very simple adjustments to the way you're working, and it can have a strong and powerful impact on what you're trying to achieve.
Well, on the culture map, do cultures work best that share a common heritage? Like, do Europeans work better with Europeans across languages, or do Asians work better with Asians, or South Americans with other South Americans?
You know, that's an interesting question, because there is some research that indicates that the highest expatriation, this highest expatriate failure rate in the world is Americans moving to the UK.
Really?
And I think often people would think that that would be Americans moving to Japan or some culture that's really different. But what happens when Americans move to the UK is that people underestimate the impact of culture. So you move to Japan, you know that culture is different. So you're reading books, you're studying, you get there, the Japanese behave strangely, and you think, oh, that's culture, I have to be flexible. But when the American goes to the UK, he's likely not thinking about culture at all, because these people speak the same language, they look the same, they eat the same food. And then when the British start behaving differently than what would be appropriate in the UK, in the US, that's misunderstood as incompetence by the Americans. So the Americans get frustrated more easily. So I guess the answer to your question is that often these cultural differences have the strongest impact when we're not expecting them and don't even realize that they are lurking.
Yeah, and I think even for those of us that don't travel internationally, you know, we're all involved in cultural differences. Larry, for instance, you give a lot of talks on the history of Park City. And Aaron, you gave an example of giving a talk and to two different audiences. In one case, you had a woman in front of you holding up, hey, you have 10 minutes left, you have 3 minutes left, you have two, you have one, time to stop. And then you had an example, it was a South American group you were talking to. And they were a little disappointed. You went exactly how long they asked you to. Originally thought you were going to talk for 45 minutes. They asked you to go a little bit longer. You went 60, and they were a little disappointed because you didn't go longer. Talk to us about that and you know, how you can ahead of time think through whether this is going to be an issue or not, so you can prevent the problem from coming up in the first place.
Right. Well, I think that's an interesting example, because on the one hand, it's not a surprise to many people to hear that in Latin America, people view time as more flexible than we do in the U.S. But what was interesting to me in that specific situation was to see how I was viewed as being unprofessional because I watched the clock so closely. So I think that really shows that, you know, when you're working with people who come from other countries, it's up to you to learn how to adapt your style so that you're perceived in the way that you desire.
Now, here in Park City, we have lots of international visitors, and I guess right now the rising area of the world that is discovering Park City, investing here, and traveling here are Asians. Do we, as their hosts, need to adjust our thinking, or is it up to the other visitors to figure out us Americans and how we do things?
Well, I guess that depends on whether you want to make a profit.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to hospitality. So if we wish to cater to Asians in general, Hong Kong, some Chinese and Japanese, how do we need to change our thinking in hospitality?
Well, one very simple thing, that one very simple trap that Americans often fall into when they're working with a Chinese or even more so with Japanese is speaking too quickly. I don't mean saying your words too quickly, but I mean jumping in on top of the person you're talking to. So in the U.S., it's quite common when we have a conversation that we kind of jump in on top of one another. And and I often see this situation where I'll have an American and a Chinese person who are communicating, and the American will ask the Chinese a question, and because the Chinese does not answer, you know, immediately on that split second, the American then answers the question themselves, for example, or asks another question, thinking that that person doesn't have anything to say. Whereas in Chinese culture, people are taught that you should listen carefully, you should let the person stop speaking, you should wait a beat, and then you should respond. So, you know, that's just a very simple way to, let's say, annoy your customers. If you have someone from China, or even more so from Japan, where you are not giving them an opportunity to give a response when you ask a question.
And then another group of tourists who visit frequently, especially in the winter to ski, would be Mexicans and South Americans. And do they come from different perspectives, or are all Spanish speakers going to react to our hospitality in similar ways?
Well, certainly every Latin American country is different. But one thing that is similar between those Latin American countries is that people tend to be much more relationship-oriented than we are in the United States. So if you have a Latin American customer who's coming into your shop frequently, taking the opportunity to be very warm and personal will be doubly important with that individual. In the U.S., we tend to get down to business too quickly sometimes, and we don't spend enough time building up those personal relationships when we're working with Latin Americans or South Americans.
So, Erin, I want to broaden the discussion a little bit. And one of the things that, one of the thoughts that surprised me as I was listening to your book, I'm a big audiobooks guy. I was listening to it while I was jogging on Sunday, is really taking it outside of the business context. As I was listening to your book, I found myself thinking about all the conflict that's in the world right now, right? It used to be there were two big enemies, the U.S. and Russia, and you're on one side or the other. But now there's all these camps of, and I guess there always have been, but it's highlighted more, camps of conflict around the globe. And I found myself thinking and wanted your thoughts on how much of this is just, do you think, based on cultural differences and a lack of an ability to understand the other party?
I think, I mean, it's hard for me to put a percentage around it, but I think certainly in politics and international politics, as in business, as in any time you're having some interaction with someone from another culture, cultural differences are impacting you. And I would say when I watch two international politicians negotiating or speaking on the TV, I notice a lot of things about their body language and their facial expressions that may signify something in their culture, but signify something different in the culture that they're working with. And a very simple one is that in the United States, we tend to smile a lot at people that we don't know, and that's just being friendly in American culture. But in many other cultures in the world, when you kind of have a big smile on your face and you're talking to someone that you don't know, it comes off as being a little bit superficial because it gives an unintended suggestion of real friendship. So that, you know, those are very small things that people are not aware of, yet they impact our ability to trust the person that we're operating with.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I was reading a story about Ronald Reagan and the Russian-U.S. conflict, and he had a famous meeting with Mikhail Gorbachev. When he came over, it was a cold day in Washington, D.C., and Gorbachev was wearing his big Russian coat. And Reagan went out there in his suit with no coat, went up, gave him a warm shake on his hand, pretend, you know, you'd never know it was below 0 degrees out that day. And the author of this book said, you know, that was the first step in Ronald Reagan's victory over Russia. And I remember thinking, really? is that kind of stuff really that important?
Well, I think that demonstrating that you're willing and interested in making an effort to adapt to the other person's culture is very important. And once people recognize that, then they're more, well, they're likely to forgive you of all sorts of mistakes that you might make. But a very simple one, for example, a very simple cultural difference that comes up frequently whenever we're interacting with people from other cultures is, what's the most appropriate way to give negative feedback in a culture, or to provide criticism? So I think in the U.S. we pride ourselves on being blunt, and we are perhaps more direct than Asians or Latin Americans are, but we are much less direct with negative feedback than in many other countries, particularly many European countries. I worked with a French woman a while ago who talked about how when she moved to the U.S., she was called into her boss's office, and her American boss started by telling her a number of things she was doing very well before he told her what she wasn't doing well. And she left the meeting thinking that her boss had given her the most positive feedback she had ever received. And that's because in France, positive feedback is given more implicitly and negative feedback is given more bluntly. Whereas in the U.S., we tend to put a lot of positivity around our criticizing. So that can be really complicated if you're not aware of it. But if you make an effort to, let's say, laugh at your own culture and show that you're willing to adapt, all of these things can be forgiven.
Yeah, you know, that brings to mind an example in your book, a British businessman saying, well, that's an original point of view to his Dutch counterpart. And what the British businessman means is, well, that's a dumb idea. But the Dutch person hears, they like my idea. It's original. And in my family, when my wife says to my or a kid's suggestion, I'll think about that, that means no. we figured I'll think about it means no. But, I mean, there are just endless variations of that. And do you have some examples of things that have just blown up because of cultural misunderstandings? One classic one from long ago was Chevy introducing the Nova in Latin America, and nobody bought it because they didn't know Nova meant no go.
Right. Well, I mean, things blow up all the time, but even more than that, what happens is that we lose the opportunity to do business internationally because we don't know how to prepare ourselves. When China is becoming so important in the world right now. I just worked with an American company very recently who had a bid for a big piece of business in Beijing, and they prepared at this beautiful presentation. They went to Beijing, they gave the presentation, every word, every slide was perfect. They got on the airplane and they came back home. Later on, they learned that they had lost the business to a company in Malaysia, and in fact, the Malaysian company had given a higher price. But what they realized as they looked more into it was that the Malaysians had understood how to build trust with the Chinese, and they'd spent time, you know, sharing meals and drinks and singing and getting to know each other at a personal level, so that when it came to the Chinese needing to choose between two equal products, they knew who they could trust to follow through on their promises. And that type of thing, I mean, if the Americans had recognized that, they could have made just a little bit of an adjustment to the way that they ran that trip, and they could have gotten a lot more business. So we have a huge opportunity in this globalizing economy if we help ourselves to learn some of these differences.
Yeah, and that's a good example of relationship building, and the Americans maybe didn't build relationships so well as the Malaysians. Is our relationships, personal relationships, equally important around the world, or are, I don't know, are the Germans pretty much all business and bottom line oriented, more so than Italians or Greeks or whoever?
So what the research that's been done on this looks at is cultures that build trust through that build trust through cognition versus affection. So cognitive trust versus affective trust. And we see that some cultures in the world, the U.S. being the most task-oriented culture in the world, in some cultures like the U.S., we are much more likely to build trust because through our brain, because we see he's on time, he does good work, I trust him. And then in most of the emerging markets, Brazil, India, Russia, China, there's a much stronger emphasis on effective trust. And I trust somebody because I feel like I know them personally, like I have empathy for them or a brotherhood with them. So this varies dramatically from one country to another. And if you can get that right, you're already on your way.
Well, let's talk about building trust, relationships, and feedback. In particular, you may be surprised to hear, what was it, yesterday, Larry? Yeah, we had snow on the mountaintops already. So winter comes here very, very early in Park City. A couple more weeks, we're going to be getting a lot of international students that are going to be spending 4 or 5 months with us here. We tend to get a lot of foreign students from South America, and businesses are going to start their training programs with these people and starting to give them initial feedback as well. So with the lens of South America, what are some things that local businesses should know about the indoctrination, the training, as well as feedback for a South American audience?
So as far as feedback goes, in general, in South America, people are much less direct with negative feedback than we are in the United States. So that means that people use more of what I call downgraders, which are words that soften the negative message. You might partially think about doing this a little bit differently, maybe. That's a lot of downgraders wrapped around the message. So for when you're welcoming clients or customers from South America, you can recognize that if you need to provide criticism or say something negative, that you should do everything to make that message as soft and diplomatic as possible.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the specifics. In Japan, there's an expression, read the air. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So Japan is, in Japanese culture, a lot of information, communication, is passed implicitly from one person to another. And I had an example of this recently. I was in Japan a few months ago. I gave a presentation to a group of Japanese. At the end, I asked if there were any comments or questions, and no one raised their hand or moved forward or opened their mouth, so I thought there were no questions. I went to go sit down. I was with a Japanese colleague, and he said to me, "Well, Aaron, you know, I think there were actually some comments. Do you mind if I try?" And I said, okay, fine. So he stood up in front of the group, and then he said, you know, did anyone have anything they would like to say? Again, no one raised their hand, but he looked very carefully at the group. And he then looked at one woman, and he said, oh, did you have something to say? And she said, yes, thank you. And she then asked a question. And then he did it again. No, do you have something to say? Oh, yes, thank you. And I couldn't figure out how he knew that those people had something to say. So afterwards, I asked him, and he at first didn't know, and then he thought about it, and he said, well, you know, it had to do with how bright their eyes are. I thought, wow, that's really tough for someone from Minnesota like myself.
So that's a pretty obscure cultural cue to pick up.
That's right. But then I pushed him, and I said, well, what do you mean how bright their eyes are? And he said, well, you know, Aaron, in Japan, we don't make as much direct eye contact as you do in the West. So when you ask if anyone has questions, most people are not looking at you directly in the eye. But a few people in the room are, and that signifies that they are happy for you to call on them if you would like to. And, you know, then I actually, the next day, I tried it. I thought, you know, can I learn to read the air also? And I realized that, yes, I could, in fact, recognize who was looking at me directly based on his instructions. So I think that just shows that even in these cultures that are so different than what we are used to, that if you show humility and curiosity and you work on building your skills, that you can really improve your interaction.
You know, let's talk about another example, and this one's not in your book. It's just one that I thought of. You know, when you think about Japan, one of the things I had not thought about prior to listening to your book is there are big differences. You know, we think of Asia as kind of one group, and we really shouldn't. China and Japan are very different in how decisions are made. There's similarities, but then there's also big differences. And for whatever reason, I started thinking about, you know, could a company like Apple Computers have come out of Japan? And my initial thought was, you know, a large part of Apple's success was due to the unique skill set that Steve Jobs had. What do you think? Could a guy like Jobs have succeeded in building a company like Apple if it was based in Japan?
Well, I think that Jobs was very American in his approach. And a product like Apple perhaps could have come out of Japan, but it wouldn't have been from someone like him. So I think that in the future, what's very interesting is that some really cutting-edge companies are looking at what is it that each country does best, and how can they then take the benefits of each of those countries and then start leveraging those cultural differences as assets for the company as a whole. And I think we're going to see more and more of that in the next decade, not just seeing cultural differences as a hindrance or a problem, but really seeing them as an advantage that we can use for a profit.
Let me ask a follow-up on that. So Apple has had multiple lawsuits against Samsung, which is a Korean company. And they say that that Samsung has blatantly copied a lot of their technology. And Samsung would say, well, gee, it inspired us, but it's different, and inspiration is okay. But lately there's been a company called, I believe it's called Xiaomi out of China. Are you familiar with it? They're going by Mi here in the U.S. But theirs is almost an identical copy. There's no effort to hide the copying that's going on. Do you think some of that is a cultural difference, given your knowledge of the Korean culture and the Chinese culture? Would you say that the Chinese are more comfortable with directly copying somebody's IP than maybe the Koreans would be?
You know, I don't actually know the answer to that question, but I do believe that that's a perfect example of what's considered to be inappropriate in one environment being considered to be appropriate and fine in another environment. And in the U.S., we are becoming more and more in contact with these different systems, and we have to learn to operate in them more every day. I don't have much of a thought beyond that about it.
Gave me an excuse to talk about Apple, which Larry knows I like doing. Let me give you another example and get your thoughts on, because you know part of it is recognizing the difference, and then part of it is what do you do now that you recognize. So a personal anecdote for me: I had a business partner had started a company. Loved this guy. He and I were like brothers. We super nice guy, but the one thing that drove me nuts, he was always late for everything. He was he grew up in Peru, and his concept of time was different than mine. Let's say I was a client of yours and talking to you about this, and you know we'd have meetings that we'd have to, you know, meetings with our investors that, you know, the meeting starts at 10 a.m. and 10 a.m. means 10 a.m. It doesn't mean 10:15. How
actually, Doug, if I can interrupt, Doug, that's Park City time.
That it is true. So how do you help somebody with this that, you know, it is important. We need to figure out a way where both of us, I need to respect his culture and his way of doing things. And yet at some point we do need to be on time for certain meetings. How would you advise the CEO on that?
So I think if you're going to that country and you're going to be doing business there, then it's up to you to adapt to them, and it's up to you to remind yourself that what feels impolite or disrespectful to you is not impolite or disrespectful in that other culture. But at other times, you know, if that person is coming into your country, or let's say that you're managing, you're leading a global team, and that you have people from Peru and the U.S. who are on the same team, and that your Peruvian team member is calling in for the meeting 15 minutes late, And that's, you know, not okay for the team. So I think whenever you're managing these multicultural situations, you have to spend a lot more time up front discussing how are we going to work together as a team. It's not enough to be flexible. And flexible is one skill, but it's not the only skill. And you need to, I mean, I've always found that if you talk about these differences, that they, you know, they just start to go away. And that if that Peruvian recognized that you felt that his behavior was disrespectful, I'm sure that's the last thing that he would want to convey to you. So the more we talk about these differences, the more we deal with them effectively.
Well, Aaron, it's been fascinating hearing about all this. And, I can see infinite numbers of ways one could inadvertently get in trouble dealing internationally. But it's good that you've written this book to help us along that path, The Culture Map, Breaking Through the Invisible Boundaries of Global Business by Aaron Meyer. Aaron, thanks for joining us on Mountain Money this morning.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Aaron, I enjoyed your book. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we will be back to talk about marketing and a local PR and marketing firm that is now opening a branch office in New York City. Generally, it would be the other way around, but we'll talk with Hillary Ryder after this.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
I'm Monica Simos with the Park City High School Minor Detail Show, informing you of current events at the high school and in the community every Saturday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tune in Saturday nights or listen online at kpcw.org and like our Minor Details Facebook page.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, Rich Fine Realtor, and Vail Resorts.
This is Eric Lee, attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo. As a Park City resident for 20 years, I'm proud to support KPCW. Jones Waldo provides legal services to residents of Summit County in many areas. 435-200-0085. JonesWaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now is Hillary Ryder of Redhead Marketing and PR. And Hillary, you've been here in Park City for a while, and you've recently decided to open a store and a office in New York City. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me on. I decided to expand to New York because it is where I'm from. It's where I grew up, where I went to college, where I worked for a couple of years before coming out here. And it was just having had my business now since 2010 and it doing quite well, it just seemed like a logical way to expand. And it allows me to offer Utah clients really great media exposure in what many of us consider to be the media capital of the world. And with New York being such a top market for Utah, it just makes a lot of sense for our clients here. And then we can also offer, you know, our same brand of personalized service and affordable rates to clients in New York who otherwise pay exorbitant fees for marketing firms.
But you're not moving there yourself, native New Yorker. You're staying put.
That seems to be the million-dollar question lately. So many people are asking me that. But no, I'm not planning to move. I do have an individual working with me in Manhattan, who's a fantastic public relations pro, and I'm so excited to have her on my team, and she'll really be an asset to my clients.
So it is the capital, not only of the U.S. for marketing and PR, but really of the world, I would think. It's got to be uber competitive there. So how do you stand out versus the firms that are already have a beachhead there?
Well, I'm essentially bringing my same business model to the city, which differs from a lot of other marketing firms there. You have pretty big firms there that have a lot of layers, and a lot of clients get frustrated that their account managers are constantly changing and they're having to re-educate a new person on the team all the time, and it's very frustrating. And with Tracy and I, we do all the work ourselves. We don't pawn it off to 22-year-olds who are right out of college to give them experience. And that's something very different than what you would find from a larger agency in New York. And that, coupled with our rates, are about half of what a New York agency is. We can attract a lot of clients who might not otherwise be able to afford professional marketing services.
So either by name or not using a name, what is who is a typical Park City client, and how could that and what services do you offer that Park City client here, and then what services can you expand to with a New York branch?
Well, a typical Park City client, as dynamic as our town is, that's how varied our client base has been. So we've had political candidates who are mostly have been local, so they wouldn't necessarily benefit from our New York presence. But other clients like restaurants and other hospitality, tourism-oriented businesses can greatly benefit for our services because they're always looking for national media exposure. They can't necessarily go to New York themselves. They may not have the budget to do that, to hire in-market agencies or to get on a plane themselves and go mingle with the media. But having a presence there allows us to do that on their behalf.
Well, and the name of your firm is easy to remember. Which is good.
Larry, people can recognize
Based obviously on anybody who knows Hillary, she stands out in a crowd with that red hair.
But you know,
my height doesn't allow me to stand out, so my hair color may as well.
In fact, take a look at last summer's cover of Park City magazine, and it is a crowd shot of the entire scene on Main Street during tour of Utah with all the cyclists and thousands of people, and your eye goes straight to Hillary
on my cell phone
standing there. I called her up and pointed it out before she'd seen the magazine. You are the only recognizable person in this picture, and of course, you're on your cell phone.
Yeah, you know, the reason I mentioned
it. PR person, I'm on my phone.
There's Larry, we had Patricia Damon in here last summer who runs the spa over at the Deer Valley Plaza. I forget the name of her spa.
Zante.
Good memory. All right. And as I recall, when I was looking at her website, you had helped her put together the website. You were helping her with the marketing. Is that correct?
Nope. She is not a client of mine.
No, I missed that. Sorry.
It's okay.
Anyway.
Sure, with some other great local firm.
Yeah, exactly. In New York City, I think of your typical client might be more of like technology, smaller startups, folks trying to get on the radar screen. Or is it more the type of mix that we have here, some restaurants, some spas, firms like that?
Well, actually, our first client is a food industry client. It's a restaurant and specialty food store in Brooklyn. We have such a passion for food ourselves, so it was exciting for our first client to be food, hospitality related. And then we're talking to somebody else about an independent film and helping them with the marketing on that. And that's the other thing, too, with Sundance being in our backyard, we can certainly help a lot of companies in New York who are looking for a presence during the film festival.
So there probably is no typical client, but what can you do other than write press releases and distribute them? What touches can you provide that help get a client's name out there?
So we do a lot of event planning and coordination to help companies market themselves to an audience that they are looking to get in front of. We also do social media and website development and branding, all kinds of graphic design work. So we're very full service, but we keep our operation very lean so that we can pass those savings on to our clients.
And your path has been through public relations. I think I recall you at Canyons Resort once upon a time. Or
well,
were
close.
You in the ski
I
business?
Was at Ski Utah and okay. The Park City Chamber and Visitors Bureau.
All right.
So
okay.
I'm pretty
so
strong
it,
in the tourism.
It came up
background.
Through the ski promotion ranks. And is it the same skill set, or have had you had to expand your offerings?
Well, I've definitely expanded my offerings. I'm a firm believer that, especially these days with so many different marketing channels out there with the digital options, that you really need cohesive strategic messaging. And if you are only offering public relations to your client, you're doing them a bit of a disservice because then they have to go elsewhere to get other services, and then you have a bunch of people working on marketing who aren't all on the same page. And then that ends up with inconsistent messaging and a greater expense for the client too.
So let's build on that. So if there's a local business here, you know, they're kind of starting off, they're doing it themselves internally at this point. How would you advise them? At what point should they start thinking about bringing in an outsider to help them with that?
Before they open their doors.
Really?
Okay. You know, I'm working with a client right now who is opening a yarn and knitting boutique at Redstone in October. And we started working on this about 2 months ago. So, and that's really starting from the very beginning with the branding work and the logo design and website development. And you want to have all of that in place before you open your business. But for other services like public relations and social media, I mean, it's never too late to get on board with that. And I encourage people, you know, to get on board with it as early as possible. But there's such a learning curve with all of these different social media avenues these days. And even once you've mastered that learning curve, just implementing it is time consuming. And if you're a physician or you're managing a restaurant, you're not in front of your computer all day to keep up with that social media communication.
So for the person you're working with before they start their business, do you have different, can you work with people on different budgets? Because one of the things is they're probably on a tight budget until they get the location open, they start getting cash flow. So frankly, you surprised me with your answer. It makes sense that, you know, start working with me before you even open, because there's a lot of things you need to do to get the word out. From a budget standpoint, can you work with folks that are on a tight budget until they get their location open?
Yeah, we've worked with very tight budgets. We just finished a project for a new nonprofit that's starting up, but they're not even starting up until late 2015. But they wanted to have their website in place so they could start fundraising efforts. And so, you know, we worked with a small budget. It was something we believed in and we were willing to do.
Nice. Well, this will have to be the last question, and it's an interesting subset of public relations. And I think Park City is at this point right now, and that's crisis PR. We're less than 100 days to ski season. We don't know if one-third of our ski offerings will even be open. And, you know, just looking at the news this morning, another example is Dickie's Barbecue. The person in the back mixed in lye, thinking it was sugar, and severely injured a customer, and Dairy Queen did the same thing, apparently.
Yeah.
Crisis PR. How do you, is it always the same approach? If you have a crisis, what do you do?
Well, I mean, those stories just make me want to eat at home all the time, and I don't know how to cook, so it would be a good weight loss program. I mean, crisis communications to me is one of the most exciting aspects of public relations. It's also one of the most challenging. And I mean,
we are in it right now in Park City in the tourism business.
Park City is in very uncertain times, and it makes me very thankful that my business doesn't really rely on the tourism market here. You know, I think I personally haven't taken sides. I actually don't ski at either of the resorts that are involved, but it's been very interesting to see how both sides have handled it. But what's been really more interesting than that is to see how the community has shifted their support. And if you read letters to the editor in the Park Record and you hear callers calling into KPCW and read comments online and social media, it's interesting to see the waves of support and how it has shifted locally between the resorts and how the resorts have chosen to handle it and address it or not.
And the tourism industry as a whole, specifically the Chamber of Commerce, is now in a different approach, as is Ski Utah. So,
well, it's very difficult because you have long lead times for publications and you want to get your advertising in and your editorial in, and you don't know what your messaging is yet.
Yeah, so we are in tough times in terms of sending a message to potential customers and visitors coming to Park City. Well, Hillary Ryder, good luck opening a new branch of Redhead Marketing in New York City.
Thank you so much.
And we will be back.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, and we will be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Do you know that members of the Park City Chamber Bureau have access to a wide array of benefits that give them an edge in the local marketplace? We offer members-only insurance and discount programs, business-to-business networking opportunities, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Special thanks to our two guests this morning, Hillary Ryder of Redhead Marketing, and then Aaron Mayer, author of The Culture Map. Two very interesting conversations. You may notice that we did not talk about patent law. Those of you with a good idea are going to have to wait a couple more weeks till we get Michael Langer in here. I guess our message got miscommunicated one way or another, and we missed them, but we'll get them in the future.
Maybe we needed a PR person.
There you go. There you go. So, Larry, congratulations. The pledge week is now behind you. It was a lot of work by you and your team, and we want to thank the Park City community for once again doing a great job of supporting the station.
Well, I want to thank two sets of people, one listeners and two staff. If you're listening to Pledge Drive, you have no idea what it takes to stage a public radio Pledge Drive. The work starts almost, we'll take a few weeks off and stand down, except that today we'll do a lessons learned session, and then we'll fairly soon we'll be up again soliciting our great businesses to provide us premiums for the next go round, and then continue the planning effort. But it's one of those things that comes down to crunch time, and stuff has to get done. And this staff has put in just amazing hours and times, days. The weekend kind of disappears the week before pledge drive.
You've got a great team, and also a lot of volunteers. I was in and out of here several times during the week, and the phones were always manned, and it takes a lot of volunteers to pull this off.
Yeah,
those of you that came in and volunteered, thank you very much.
Thank you to everyone and who volunteered, and to staff, Cindy, Monica, Ethel, most specifically, are intimately involved in this and worked just extraordinary hours, and always do, and do it with a smile on their faces, generally. And then the response from you, the listeners, is really heartening. A lot of individual messages are added along with the contributions, and it's just wonderful to hear everyone respond.
So Larry, you shared with me an email from a listener that said it was new to town, and just said how much she actually enjoyed listening to pledge drives.
which
I think part of it is, the small town focus, how we do the thank yous, and also the premiums. Most stations don't give premiums when people call in to donate.
Indeed, that's one of the unique things. A person who pledged and then added that comment said she always, as a matter of habit, turned off the radio during pledge drives. And this one, she was actually tuning in.
That's a big compliment to you and your team.
Which is something. And part of it is the parade of great people who come through in the course of a week, those who offer the challenge grants and so on. We're just so grateful to them for helping to get the phones ringing, and then the public for responding. I think nearly 900 responded, individual callers. So that's very heartening, and we sure appreciate it. We also appreciate our great sponsors who bring the public affairs shows, specifically this one, Mountain Money, sponsored by Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough. Thank you all so much for supporting Mountain Money and all of the public affairs hours. And looking at the weather, we've got a 40% chance of thunderstorms today. High of 71, same chance tonight. Tomorrow, a little bit better chance, 50-50 tomorrow for thunderstorms. And thunderstorms still in the forecast all the way through Thursday, so this crazy weather continues.
It is crazy, but take advantage of it. Turn those sprinklers off. If you haven't done it yet, now is the time.
Yeah, there is no need to be watering your lawn. Thanks for joining us. That was Mountain Money for this day. This is KPCW Park City.